Last week, during Adele's sharing with us her reflections on her medical and spiritual journey of this last year, she said this: "I learned so much during this time about savoring the small moments. And it turns out they're actually the big moments. I find that it's not too difficult to get confused about what's important, about what's really the big and what's truly the small thing. Especially in the midst of conflict or when I'm distracted or when I'm feeling a bit run down. Things that are big or flashy can divert my attention from what's seemingly lesser, but actually quite significant. Some things, some events, some stories, they just capture our attention. They grab us. They take up all the oxygen in the room. And in doing so, they can certainly cause me anyway to miss noticing things that can actually have great, if not even greater, consequence. Something I learned was necessary during my work in emergency departments over the years was not to get too focused on the person who was moaning the most loudly." Right, Lil? "Because they might not, in fact, be the sickest. It was often the most quiet individual. And yes, sometimes the presenting issue wasn't even the most pressing or the most dangerous thing. Sometimes that sore shoulder could actually be a sick heart. Experience suggests that it's often wise to keep your eyes peeled for the small things because they just might be the most important element at play." Well, in our Bible reading from Genesis 2 today, there are undoubtedly some big things going on. The book of Genesis, which gets its name from the Greek word that means birth or origin, well, it's the book of Genesis is about the beginning of things. The opening line sets the scene. "In the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth." In other words, it's about the start of everything. And in that first chapter, we read how God spoke into the darkness and set existence in motion through those words, "Let there be light." God saw that this work was good, and so began the cycle of creating and delighting in what had been crafted. On day two, it's the atmosphere and the earth. On day three, it's the dry ground and plant life. On day four, the sun, the moon, the stars, they appear. Then on day five, we get the birds and the sea creatures, followed on day six by the land animals, and at last, humans, who we're told are made in the image of God and who have a most individual role in the created order. At the end of 6 days work, and interpret that how you choose, but the end of those 6 days of work, God takes a break, takes the seventh day off, blessing it and making it a holy day. Yes, God takes a holiday. And this is time free from this working, from this creating business that God's been about. Since the very first Jewish faithful had the Genesis story told to them, they heard that what followed that creation account in chapter 1, well, was another telling of the same story. In chapter 2 of Genesis, we encounter a somewhat differently focused version of some parts of that first chapter, which leads at least some to wonder if there might have been some different author's hands at work in the writing, and maybe there was. Who knows? What I do know is that in that section of Genesis 2 that we heard this morning, we encounter a compelling, timeless, and attention-grabbing issue. And I want to name it right up front so that we can acknowledge it and then pay some attention to what appears to be a smaller, a lesser issue, but I firmly believe to be a no less important concern. It's spelled out in the opening verse, verse 18. "It's not good for," and I'm going to use the Hebrew word here, it'll be familiar to you, Adam. "It's not good for humans, Adam, to be alone." And yes, in the previous chapter, that word Adam gets translated in much the way, so it refers to all of humankind. And so I think in the context of our reading today, it's fair to say that it's also a larger reference to human beings in general. Human beings in general thrive in relationship as opposed to being disconnected, isolated. And as the story goes on, the answer to that concern about isolation, we're told, is the creation of a helper. And while it's a technically accurate translation of the word helper, it's also the same Hebrew word that's used to describe how God helps humanity elsewhere in the Old Testament. So that's a pretty high status for helper, I'd say. Which is why in my Bible, anyway, the second half of the 18th verse is translated as, I will make him a helper as his partner. So back to that in a second. In verse 21, the author picks up on this theme and we read how God makes the man. And yes, in this part of the reading, it means a male. Causes the man to go into a deep sleep, which allows God to remove one of his ribs, out of which God makes him a partner, a woman. And the rest, as they say, is history. And what a history it's been. And this is the big story that captures our attention. This relationship between the sexes, which is a complicated one. One which, me being the man of insight, courage, learning, and principle you know me to be, I will avoid talking about today. Okay, not quite. Let me just offer a couple of thoughts before I move on. First, I take from this passage, and it's reinforced through my whole life experience, is that it's just not good for us to be alone. You and me, we tend to do better when we're in relationship. And whether or not it's a spousal relationship, which not all of us find or choose or figure we're cut out for, but whether it's that kind of relationship or it's a relationship of intimate friendship, well, for all sorts of reasons, there's health in being in relationship, in being in and participating in a close community. So it's generally not good for us to be alone. It's better to be with. It's better to be connected. The second thought I have is this, and I'm happy to have some more conversation about this, just not during the sermon, okay? But I believe that God has made us to live in an egalitarian relationship, to live in partnership. There's much more that gets me to this position in my reading of the scriptures, much more than we have time for this morning. But I do believe that this text is actually an important piece of that discussion. This relationship is meant to be a partnership. It's not one of categorical dominance and submission, but of complementing one another with our character, our strengths, and our qualities. I actually think there's a clue to this in God's choice in selecting the rib, not a bone from the foot or a part of the skull, but a piece of rib to create the partner. We are to be together, rib by rib, side by side. Mostly the same, but not quite the same. Not superior or inferior, but equal value, an equal value in the eyes of God. And so therefore, an equal value in our eyes as well. As I said, I'm happy to have more conversation about this. It's a complicated issue. But it's a really important conversation to have. But I've said it, haven't I? It's important. And it's been one of the defining political issues of this last century. And I would suggest just one of the more critical issues in human history. The occasionally confounding relationship between sexes has consumed a lot of air in a lot of rooms. And I suspect has done so in many ways since Eve and Adam left the garden. Have you ever noticed how there are some stories in the Bible that occasionally get designated as kids' stories? And I suppose you can see how some scripture passages might be especially attractive to the young. I mean, Zacchaeus, he was small in stature, which is why he had to go climb up that tree to see Jesus. And kids do tend to experience the world in that way, at least for a while, until they get tall enough. And similarly, David's a child when he successfully takes on Goliath, the giant. And when most of the people in your world are bigger and more powerful than you, you can see why that story might be a winner. And then there's, of course, the account of Noah's Ark, which when you stop to think about it, well, why the story of God killing off the vast majority of humanity is especially a kid's story, I find that to be a bit of a puzzle. But, you know, the animals two by two, it's an appealing picture. And it does make for countless variations of animal and ark sets. Good marketing opportunities for the Acme Toy Company. Those are some of the stories that are often understood as appealing to the young. But any adult not paying attention to those same stories is a bit foolish, for they are, in my opinion, no less applicable to us too. In fact, they're critically important truths. Which brings us to verses 19 and 20 of our reading from Genesis. This rather endearing picture of Adam naming the animals. Kid's story. Well, I'd like to argue that it's no less important to us than the big issues of male and female relationships. Back in 1979, I remember it well, Bob Dylan released an album called Slow Train Coming. And it rapidly became a bit of a controversial album, at least in some circles. See, Dylan was searching in some overtly Christian places, and the album reflected that in all sorts of ways. After the song titled Gotta Serve Somebody, a song I highly recommend, by the way, I think it punctures rather well our pretensions of independence. The next most controversial song on the album was one called Man Gave Names to All the Animals. And it's provocative. It was provocative because it sounded like a kid's song and not at all serious. And so this song shocked some of Dylan's fans because, number one, for some, Christianity was simply not a cool place to look. How dare Dylan do that? And two, Dylan is viewed, if nothing else, he's serious. So why is he singing a kid's song? And yes, his lyrics are quite simple. God's not actually mentioned in the song, curiously enough. But Dylan sings about the man looking at an assortment of animals and rather randomly assigning them names. Names not necessarily related or to function or appearance or nature. They're just names, like we might assign names to our children. And the repeated chorus concludes with this lyric. Man gave names to all the animals in the beginning, long time ago. He apparently used to sing this a fair bit at his concerts in that time, but it wasn't a great crowd favorite, so it kind of got dropped off the playlist. In one reader's poll, the song was rated as the fourth worst in his repertoire. Because, I mean, it's a kid's song. It's not serious. Though for a supposed kid's song, it ends in a rather odd way. See, the verses have a rather sweet rhythm and rhyme to them. And what Dylan does is he telegraphs the identity of the animal that is being named in the rhyme in each verse. For example, in the fourth verse, he sings, he saw an animal leaving a muddy trail, real dirty face and a curly tail. He wasn't too small, he wasn't too big. I think I'll call it a pig. But in the final verse it goes, he saw an animal as smooth as glass, slithering his way through the grass. I saw him disappear by a tree near a lake. And then the song just ends. It just ends right there. And the listener is desperately trying to find an animal rhyme for the word lake. Or maybe it would be a reptile rhyme. And when people do make that connection, not too hard. It's actually a bit chilling, isn't it? Some kid's song. In Genesis 2:19, we read that God made the animals and the birds from the same material he made humans from the earth. And then God brought them to the lonely Adam for naming. And wouldn't you know it, whatever the human named the creature, that was its name. Seriously, do you think that God couldn't think up a name? Of course not. Now, what was happening here is God was purposefully including humanity into creation in a most particular way, giving us a task in the created order. For those of you who are so blessed, and in my life it's been a tremendous blessing, but for those of you so blessed with the gift of children, do you remember naming them? It was a really big deal for Tevis and me. We thought long and hard about naming our kids, and we chose those names with great care. We gave them unfamiliar Irish names that they would always have to spell and explain. our daughter Eilish has never been called the same name twice while waiting for her coffee in Starbucks. They always mess it up. But those names were, and they are, really, really precious to us. We didn't hold a draw on naming. We didn't ask our community to tell us what names their names should be. Because naming's intimate. It's special. It can have consequence. And if you don't believe it can have consequence, well, if we had time, this is the moment that we'd all sit and listen to Johnny Cash's version of A Boy Named Sue. Names have consequence. Not having experience in this area, I asked Diane about the advisability of naming farm animals, and she let me know that you tend not to give names to animals you're going to eat. Well, let's munch on, Ralph here, Because naming, it makes things personal. Naming establishes a closeness, a connection. That's one of the reasons we encourage name tags here. Names are a way into relationship. Relationship with each other, relationship with God. I have a hunch with the world around us. And relationship is very much what we are about in the Christian church. In the biblical story, names and the act of naming are quite important. In fact, knowing and naming another's name often carries with it a particular authority. And if you want to try that out yourself, just call out someone's name and they will typically stop whatever they're doing to look at you. Knowing a name grants you power. In that famous story in Genesis 32, the reason Jacob wanted to know the name of the one he was wrestling with throughout the night was because knowing that name would give him authority. It would give him an advantage in the struggle. And you remember what happened to Jacob? Well, he nearly held his own. He walked away with a limp. But Jacob himself was given a new name by the Lord. Jacob was renamed Israel. That is one who wrestles with God, which is what Israel means. It's not an accident that we find the story about how humans are given a special role, a special authority in the created order by being given the responsibility of naming. It's not an accident that we find it in the middle of this passage. It's not an accident that we find it in a section that's all about the issue of the importance of being in relationship. A relationship that a good many experience is intensely intimate. One in which we experience becoming as one flesh, as it was described near the end of our text this morning. It's a story where humanity receives special authority, and with that authority goes some special obligation, some important duties as well. It's not good for us to be alone. And men and women are not alone in creation. Not too long ago, I had the distinct pleasure of spending some time with two rather prominent, in fact, internationally known individuals who are most active publicly in environmental concerns. And these are people who have a particular focus on our relationship with living creatures. Ironically, it was at a wedding reception. And many of you will know from recent sermons about my sometimes complicated feelings about wedding receptions. But this was really fun. And they were really good company. And as we chatted, they were honestly surprised that the Christian church might at all be interested in the issues related to climate and the environment. And I was surprised that they were surprised. And that term eco-discipleship that I shared with them, that the followers of Jesus would be concerned about and perceive as part of their mission, creation care, well, that was immediately something that opened up opportunities for discussion. And friends, afterwards, I realized that it was actually an evangelism moment. It really was, because our conversation then moved on into matters spiritual. And they got talking about their faith. Now, it's my observation that we in the church, on occasion, slip into what's usually a well-meaning habit of discerning trends and cultural shifts, and then we run to the front of the line and we say, follow us, we have the answers. So to be quite clear, this concern about our relationship with the world is not simply the flavor of the day. It's been an important element of our human calling by God from the moment we came into being. God invited us into a place of responsibility in God's creation. And it's not at all coincidental that Jesus' stories so often employed images from creation, and that some of his most impressive miracles demonstrated his connection and his authority in and even above nature. This is a critical conversation for the church to be involved in today, because we have something to offer, and its value can't be overstated, what we're offering. If we are to have an opportunity to have a conversation about Jesus with a massive number of our young who were out marching on Friday, we're going to have to be able to make some connection on this issue of our relationship to creation. Because they are not going to engage in conversation with us if we can't do that. This kid's story that we know will need to be told and explored to allow us to tell those other varying parts of the larger story. A key part of that beginning in the next chapter, in Genesis chapter 3. We are being reminded today that this relationship is a significant element of our Christian life. A relationship that the church, to be fair, has misplaced and at times misunderstood at different times in our history. So this is a critical conversation for the church to be involved in today. And we do have something to offer. And this something, this critical thing that we have to offer, is hope. And hope seems to be something that's in horrendously short supply today. One figure was saying that we need to panic about the issue of climate change. People do terrible things when they panic. Good decisions don't get made in panic. People do terrible things when they lose hope. And we have hope in what God's done and what God's doing. Read Paul's description of what God's doing, not just in us, but in the whole of creation in Romans chapter 8. Paul's speaking about the fall of all creation, and through Christ, the redemption of the whole of creation. To borrow from the famous John chapter 3 passage, it's a hope that in the God who sent his only Son, that the world would be saved. Hope personified in Jesus Christ, hope in the one who through his death and resurrection redeems all things. From Diane's text from Colossians last week, Jesus, who is, and I quote, the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, for in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him God was pleased to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, by making peace through the blood of his cross. We have responsibility, and we have very good news. News that our world is dying to hear. Friends, let us pray.